The word of God is alive and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of the soul and the spirit and of the joints and the marrow, and is a critic of thoughts and intents of the heart. All scripture is God-breathed and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God might be mature, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Open the word of truth this morning to Ecclesiastes chapter 10. Where we are ready to move on with verses 12 through 15. God doesn't want moved. All right, as Jesus Christ promised in one of the parables, the steward who is found doing his job in the last days, providing the rations for his fellow slaves and soldiers in the angelic conflict, is up for great reward. We firmly believe that providing rations involves leading the sheep to food, that is, to providing the spiritual nutrition that is necessary so that believers can assimilate the plan of God, so that they can grow in grace and knowledge, so that they ultimately can bring these things to bear in their own lives, apply faith towards the principles of the truth, and then ultimately apply them in the angelic conflict. We recognize that we run a race, but the race is a marathon. It is not a sprint. You have to be in this for the long haul. You will have your good miles. You will have your bad miles. But the necessity is to keep on running. As Paul said to the Philippians, put those things behind you which are behind you. Move ahead. Keep your eyes focused on the prize. And even though you may have problems, you may hit the wall spiritually, the fact is you can continue to pick up and move forward. So in that regard, this is available, God's grace, to everybody who will avail themselves of it. And we are here to exalt that grace through the teaching of His Word, which provides the spiritual nutrition necessary for positive believers in the last days. So it's time to make sure you are in fellowship. We recognize that the enemy of all this is internal. We have external enemies, but when it comes to taking in doctrine, everything needs to be put aside, particularly the sin nature, who cannot be in the position of rulership, or the believer just simply warps and distorts what he hears along the lines of his own preconceived notions, his own sinful trends. So this is absolutely critical, so it's time to rebound if necessary, and anything else you need to do to put aside distractions, focus your attention, concentrate, and profit from the teaching. Let us pray. Well, Heavenly Father, we thank you for the freedom we enjoy in this country so that we can continue to pursue the objectives of your plan. We recognize that all things in your plan are advancing to the foreordained conclusion, that from eternity past, your eternal plan has comprehended everything into eternity future. We recognize that because of this, there is nothing that you do not know. There is nothing that takes you by surprise. There is nothing that shocks you. And all things have been worked out by you in advance so that your plan is certain to come to fruition. We thank you for being a part of your plan through grace and pray as we approach your word this morning that God the Holy Spirit will bless our thinking and continue to guide us in all the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen. All right, well, here we have, we're going to look at him for the last time pretty much in this book, not to say that there are not other foolish things to which Solomon will allude, but here in chapter 10 we see the great contrast between the wise man and the fool, between wise behavior and foolish behavior. We see folly, or stupidity, in terms of those under authority. We see sometimes folly is exercised by those in authority. So all of this, of course, sets up this great contrast, and here we're going to see now the speech of the fool. One last look at it. We'll get in the first three verses here, 10 or 12, 13, and 14. And then the last one, sort of vague at some level, but the gist of it is, as we can probably tell, it is another indictment of the fool and his stupidity. That folly rules in the life of this type of person, as we have seen, who is contrasted with the wise man, that they go, in a sense, different ways, not only physically, but spiritually in life. So the words from the mouth of a wise man bring a favorable response, while the lips of a fool consume him. And then, of course, here, the one question we do have to answer, and we're going to, is that when it says the word, it says, essentially you have a nominal sentence in the Hebrew, the words of the mouth of wise men, the wise man, here is grace. And again, the question would become, is it speaking about the gracious speech that proceeds from the lips of the wise man? Or is it talking, as the New American Standard is translated it here, about a gracious response, a favorable response on the part of the one who hears? While the lips of a fool consume him, the beginning of his talking is stupidity, and the end of it is insane, wicked insanity. And so it goes from bad to worse when dealing with a fool. He will not, of course, because of the nature of his choices, pull himself out of this. He does not want to hear that he needs to pull himself out of this. He does not want to hear that he's wrong, and so he cuts himself off from everybody that could correct him at any level. And so the fool continues to make bad choices. Again, the idea of the fool is not a person who is mentally deficient, but one with the propensity for making bad choices. And the bad choices just go on and on and on. There never is an end to them, is the problem. And that's why when you're dealing with a fool, one must determine very quickly what the action is to be. And we have, of course, a number of things in the Scripture that suggest certain times we are to deal with fools according to their stupidity and point out how stupid they really are. And other times we are to keep our mouths shut and just absorb it, let the fool go on and think he's fine in his own eyes and that you agree with him. Even though he's interpreting your silence as tacit agreement, the fact is there are times to maintain the silence instead of casting pearls before swine. And in that analogy, this is the swine. The fool is the swine. The pearls are the pearls of wisdom and doctrine that the believer has. And there comes a point at which the fool is just so not amenable to this that there's no point in even talking to him. It just becomes a waste of time. And more than that, for the positive believer, for the wise man, interaction with the fool is distasteful, to say the least. Very unpleasant. And it doesn't ever get any better, is the sad thing. These are the realities that govern the conflict. The beginning of his talking is stupidity. The end of it, wicked insanity. Yet the fool multiplies words. You can't stop him. He's got something to say. And he figures since he thinks it, it must be right. Since he thinks it, you must need to know it. And therefore, he's got to articulate it. And he goes on and on. And yet, no one knows what will happen. And he pontificates on the future, as fools do. And who can tell him what will come after him? The answer here, the question, suggesting a no answer. No one can. Nobody knows the future fully. The only extent to which we know the future in a general sense comes from orientation to prophecy. But Solomon didn't have many of the prophecies that you and I have about the future. And Solomon was less knowledgeable about the future than we are, although we live in ostensibly the best time in history. As we live towards the end of human history, you would have the best view of all of, one, the past events. We can look at human history from the beginning of Adam all the way through, study it. And then prophetically, at the end of time, you would be the most likely to be at least knowledgeable and hopefully oriented to the prophetic word and what is coming down the pike. And as I sent out a couple of emails, if you haven't read them yet, but Russia is definitely gearing up. They launched another nuclear submarine that has a distance, a capability of striking from 5,000 miles with multiple warheads. Well, you don't have to be too close to the U.S. to make that work. And, of course, we continue to act as though nothing will happen and all that. But the fact is, we know the prophecies. We understand that Babylon the Great in the last days, the richest, most powerful nation on the planet, is going to go down. Solomon didn't know that, but we know that. And so we live our lives in, literally, there's a book entitled Living in the Shadow of the Second Coming. And we do. We live at that point in history. So while we have some general knowledge of what the future holds, and we couldn't give you exact times or dates, and anybody that claims to be able to is to be avoided like the plague. Nobody knows. So nobody knows what will happen. Who will tell him what will come after him? No one. The toil of a fool so wearies him that he does not even know how to go to a city. And what they have done here is how to walk. He cannot figure out how to walk. Again, you have the verb yada here, to know something, to figure out something, to recognize something, followed by an infinitive construct, which is very often an expression that's designed to know how to do something, not rather just to know it, but to know how to effectively operate in a situation. And that was the last thing we looked at, so we are ready to dive into this tonight, this morning rather. Although Solomon, point one, has spent a good deal of time in this book pointing out that wisdom has only a relative advantage. I mean, if you read the book, you figure out that Solomon recognizes the limitations of wisdom. Number one, all wisdom ends when you die. So there's number one limitation. Death is the first primary limitation to wisdom. But then there are so many other limitations to wisdom. The wise man himself can make a foolish mistake sometimes. There is oppression that would tend to counteract wisdom. There is bribery and extortion that are attempts to counteract wisdom and fairness and justice and all that. And so many, many things can seek to undermine wisdom. And so Solomon knows this. He's not a fool. He's lived long enough in this world to figure it out. As he lives here towards the end of his life, and looking back, he sees the whole picture. And Solomon is well qualified to comment on this. The wisest man in the world now towards the end of his life, and he has to know. Solomon has to know, if he's intellectually honest, the sorts of blunders that he has made, and how that they have not advanced God's plan. Solomon would have had to figure this out. So did Solomon have, in some way, some lupe attached to his life at this point? I think he did. I think any positive believer would look back and say, you know, I didn't really do quite so well there, if he judges himself rightly. But Solomon said, instead of wallowing in self-pity, I've blown it, I can't do anything, Solomon writes a book and says, here, I've got some ideas for you about how to live, young people. And again, the primary target audience is young men, most likely his son, right on down, the next generation. So while he says wisdom has only a relative advantage, and it does, many things can undermine it, he never endorses its opposite. He never suggests, well, okay, so just forget it and be a fool. Solomon never, ever adopts that attitude throughout this book. In fact, he continues to ridicule the fool right up till the very end. Two, these four verses, that's kind of mean of Solomon ridiculing the fool like this, but somebody's got to do it. And it's best that a wise man does, really, if you think about it. And Solomon was well qualified for this. Two, these four verses make it explicit that Solomon did not have any regard for the fool. Further, he clearly perceived wisdom to be superior to folly. And that's another whole issue, is that while wisdom has its limitations, one of the things we saw throughout this book, we haven't seen them so much lately, but he has used these better than expressions throughout the book. Such and such is better than such and such. A live dog is better than a dead lion. Well, he uses these contrasts to show that there are some things that are better than other things under the sun. And while we may not always see what they are, we may not always quite grasp it. In fact, is Solomon said, you never will fully grasp everything. You have to acknowledge that certain things work better than other things. And anybody would, you know, in a sense, this only boils down to common sense. And Solomon here endorses common sense throughout this. He never says, well, throw your common sense out the window because you're going to die. He doesn't say that. Three, he has described the path of the fool in verse 2, but now turns to deal with the speech of the fool, which is again contrasted with the actions of a wise man in both cases. But again, the primary emphasis on here is on how stupid people can be. The wise man is the foil for this. He shows up in relief to the fool. The fool claims whatever he claims, but he might claim many things, many grandiose things, no doubt. And yet the fool doesn't have certain fundamental things in place and can't figure out certain fundamental truths. That's what destines him to remain a fool. So the fool here is contrasted with the wise man. 4 verses 12 and 13 are proverbial in character. They set forth the fact that fools insist on verbalizing all that is in their thinking, often to their own detriment. And there's another verse in Proverbs, of course, which is very good. And he who holds his lips is considered wise. So why talk and remove any doubt? Just keep your mouth shut at some level, and even if you're a fool, you may get by with it. The fool is not identified sometimes. If he will, just keep quiet. He could keep his folly to himself. Unfortunately, the nature of the fool doesn't allow him to do that very much. He's certain that he's got something to say. He's certain you need to hear it. And no matter how stupid it may be, he's going to articulate it. And no matter how at odds with the plan of God it may be, he's got his own view on it, and that's it. Hey, he goes on in verse 13 to deal with the fact that the speech of a fool is idiotic in the first place. And then it descends into absolute insanity. B, the first part of verse 14 is designed to be a strong indictment of the fool, who cannot and does not accomplish anything of any value with all his words. The fool multiplies words. Why? Because he doesn't really have the reality of the truth behind him, and so he has to view life as he sees it. And as he sees it, then he has to convince himself he's okay, and then he has to try to convince others. That's the nature of the beast. Five, the first portion of verse 12 has prompted two interpretations. The first suggests that the words of the wise have a gracious character. For instance, Psalm 45:2 gives a reason for this suggestion. You are fairer than the sons of men. Grace is poured out upon your lips. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. The Hebrew phrase, favor is poured out on your lips, is one in which the lips stands by metonymy for the king's speech. That is, representing the actions of something by something associated with it. And B, some interpret the Hebrew term ken here, grace, as referring to gracious speech, which is viewed as speech that is kind and polite. And C, however, the word probably refers more generally to speech that is attractive, impressively articulated, and appropriate to the occasion. That is the nature of gracious speech, is that it is appropriate to the time. That's one of the principles we get in the New Testament about having a word ready for the time. And as a timely word, fitly spoken, is related to apples of gold and settings of silver, which is designed to point out the nature of saying the right thing at the right time. Six, the second and far more likely interpretation based on the context is that the words of the wise affect favor for the wise person. The words of the wise man knows how to conduct himself and articulate what he wants to say and do in such a way as to win the approbation of people, at least to win their respect. And at a certain level, that's really all you can shoot for, is to have a person's respect. They don't have to like you in that level, at that sense, but they should respect you if you are a wise man, because your words will be appropriate to the time and have the appropriate force, and in some cases not have to be very many in number. The wise person doesn't have to talk forever to communicate what he wants to get at. And the wise person, again, if he thinks through what he says, very often it would certainly appear that the fool does not think through what he says. If he did, why would he do it? Because thinking through it would point out to him that this is no good. But again, you've got this whole big package you have to look at: the mental attitude of the fool, the verbal activity of the fool, the overt activity of the fool, and the hardcore nature of the fool. The fool is, again, by his very own choices, entrenching him in a position that is not only dangerous, but will turn out to be deadly in the long run. That ultimately it will not win the day. So, seven, the interpretation is consistent with what follows in the latter portion of the verse, which indicates that the fool's words damage him, while the wise man's words result in approval. So I take it to mean here in this sense that as they've translated it in the New American Standard, that the words of the wise, words from the mouth of the wise, bring a favorable response. Now we know that that can't be true in an unqualified sense, because the wise man has spoken, as surely Solomon knows, many times in history, and was not always received with favor. But that what he's talking about in these Proverbs is the general character of things. That generally speaking, people will respond favorably if a person knows how to conduct themselves and handle themselves in public. And this is another whole issue as we see here. This is the fool on parade. This is the fool out in public. Much as we saw back in the verse 3, even when the fool walks along the road. Walking along the road there is equivalent to being out in public. And when the fool gets around people in public, he cannot control himself. He can't handle things. The fool doesn't know when to be quiet. And when he does talk, very often all he does is spout folly. So his speech is just almost worse than useless. It doesn't amount to anything. And yet the fool figures you should be listening to him. No thanks. Pass. I'll let that one go. I can make enough dumb mistakes on my own. I really don't need a fool giving me advice on how to do it. So the point is, this type of person is at some level to be rejected, of course. And again, depending upon the situation, to tell him he's a fool or else just let him go his own way, let him be a fool. Either way, the end result is going to be the same. The fool will go his own self-destructive way. 8, the contrast is made between the mouth of the wise man and the lips of a fool. But both are used by metonymy for their speech. What comes out of their mouth, their words. 9, the second part of the verse completes the image that the words of the wise have positive effects, while the words of a fool ultimately bring harm to him. 10, the fool's speech results in his destruction, as his own lips swallow him. That's actually the verb that's there. Consume him is the way they've translated it. Ba'lah, the verb there, means to swallow something down. And it gets into the idea of the whole process of swallowing. So the fool destroys himself. We saw that previously, too. If you look back in Ecclesiastes 4, we saw that the stupidity of the lazy fool. Verse 5 of chapter 4, the fool folds his hands and cannibalizes his own flesh. Well, that's not very good. I'm pretty sure, I don't know how I want life to go, but I'm pretty sure I don't want to sit around and consume myself. Why? Because the fool is lazy. The fool does not see the value of hard work. He does not believe that hard work is for him or that it's necessary. And the person that will not work hard, does not work hard, doesn't want to work hard, is set up for a self-destructive path in life anyway. Because that ultimately will not work out in this world. One of the things we see about life under the sun, although it can be undermined by many things, is that God prospers and blesses diligence and hard work. Solomon, while not coming out and saying that per se, certainly implies it when we get into chapter, later on in this chapter actually, verse 18, through indolence the rafters sag, and through slackness the house leaks. This is designed to point out that the folly of laziness is that it collapses things right around you that you should be taking care of. And so the lazy person ultimately will suffer under his own laziness, under his own stupidity. So the wise man, verse 11, the really wise man uses words that grace the ears of the hearer, create the right impression, and have the potential to elicit a favorable reaction. 12, the fool, however, is careless and inept with his words, which ultimately destroys or consumes his own case. Even if a fool has a point about something, and even if he's correct, very often it's lost in the muddle of stupidity that surrounds it. And the fool likes to focus on the one thing he's right about, of course. Or he may be right about. At least he's right in his own mind. But even if he is correct, the way he goes about it, the way he handles it, the type of response he elicits, undermines everything he's trying to do. The fool ultimately cannot really accomplish very much. But he'll have a lot of talk. He'll have a lot of things to say about it. He can try to convince you he's accomplishing a lot. But obviously, not much is getting done. 13, even if the fool is passionate about what he believes and is attempting to accomplish, he will find that the inability to guard his lips may finally be his undoing. And that is the reality of it, is the fool, again, is so certain that he's right that he's got to articulate it to you. He's got to tell you how right he is. Well, guess what? There's right, and then there's right in your own eyes. The fool very often is nothing more than right in his own eyes. 14, Solomon continues in verse 13 with an indictment of the fool, focusing on the beginning of his speech and continuing to detail the fact that his speech finally descends into absolute insanity. 15, this verse spans the entire process, beginning with its foolish starting point and culminating in its spiritually disastrous end. When a person goes insane, physically or spiritually, they're not the same person any longer. They have lost, in a sense, the essence of who they are. That's the nature of insanity. The fool loses the point of who he really even is. But it doesn't stop him, doesn't slow him down. And I suppose they've suggested that the insane person really doesn't think he's insane. He thinks he's normal. And the rest of the world is, you know, Martians or something. Or whatever it is they think about the rest of the world. But their view of it is, in their mind, correct. No matter how far away it may be from what we would even consider to be truthful. So the crazy person probably doesn't recognize he's crazy. But that's the beauty of doctrine. With knowing that evil insanity resides in all of our hearts, we recognize that we're insane to start with. And that, guess what? Doctrine's what saves us. That's what provides sanity in this insane world. That's what provides the nature, that's how we understand grace. That's why it's another title for it, is the word of grace. This is how we get God's plan. And God's plan is ultimate spiritual reality. Ultimate reality exists. The truth exists out there, to coin a phrase. And we can find it. But the fool's not interested in finding the truth. The fool thinks he has the truth. And the fool thinks if you don't agree with him, then you're wrong. Well, guess what? The reality is if you don't agree with God, you're wrong. And God pretty well sets his word straightforward. I don't think very much of what we study and what we see in the Christian life is vague. I think it's all pretty straightforward. But Jesus was, as we saw, a very straightforward teacher who talked with a relative level of authority that did not characterize the false teachers of his day. He recognized the truth and he would not back off on it. And that's the beauty of God's plan. Once one locks into the truth, then they recognize the truth. And they say, okay, nothing is going to shake me on this. And you'll have every sort of opportunity to have a crisis of faith in your life that you're going to want, and more. And you may have several crises of faith in your life as you grow spiritually. You may hit rock bottom. But when you hit rock bottom, you've got two choices. You can either get up and go, or you can stay there. You can go sideways, or you can go back up. You can't go down any further after rock bottom. That's pretty much it. And one thing that you find out with doctrine is that the bottom of doctrine is solid. These principles of the truth have been tried throughout the course of human history. They have been proven in the lives of believers. They work. We know they work. They have gotten believers through every sort of possible situation, the scenario you could even imagine. And people have done all sorts of things and still made it spiritually. Why? Because they were loyal to the truth in the end. That characterized their life. So if we have to listen to the fool, he's indicted here, it descends again, starts out bad and goes worse, and continues to deteriorate. Well, if you're not exposing yourself to the truth on a regular basis, guess what? You're going to deteriorate. And while the Christian way of life is analogous to a race, a long race, a marathon, you don't necessarily run the same speed all the time in a marathon. Now, the really good runners do. They run, they'll set a particular pace, but they will change it up even during the course of the race. They may run a 4.5-minute mile. They may be happy to run a 4.75-minute mile for several miles, depending upon the nature of the competition and all those things. So you have to be content to be willing to run, to recognize that I've just got to keep moving forward, exposing myself to the truth. And again, as we pointed out, while your level of understanding of the truth may be up here and your application down here in that it will always lag behind, the fact is we should try to close this gap as we can. But even when we can't close it, if we keep pushing this up, this will follow, in my opinion, if you're positive and you're wanting to apply. This will follow. So you continue to expose yourself to the truth, to challenge yourself, to hear those things which are conducive to living the Christian life, to being successful at it. I don't want to just live it and get through it and say, well, I survived planet Earth, and that's going to be some people's t-shirt, I guess, in heaven. What do you get? Well, I just got this t-shirt. Well, it's not much of a reward, but okay. I survived planet Earth. I survived life under the sun. Well, I don't want to just survive. I want to excel and thrive, don't you? I don't want to just get by. And to me, one of the great blessings, one of the great rewards in time is being able to study and to understand and articulate the Word of God. To be able to know these principles, and even when you fail at them, and I fail just like you fail every day, that, guess what, these things work. We know they work. They work for believers for years. They have been, as it's called, gold refined by fire. They've been tried in the most difficult of circumstances, dare I say it, from the lion's den to the flood to the hot furnace. Right on through. And these people made it. Why? Because they had the right idea, those three Jews. They had the right idea. We're not serving you or your gods, even if our God doesn't deliver us. We don't care. We're still going to serve him. What he does is his choice. And that shows a lot of wisdom and a lot of humility. And those guys had it together. And God worked in their lives and delivered them. Now, surely they weren't any different than you and I. Surely they had STAs and failed in many ways. They might have done things that would shock you. I don't know what they did or didn't do. But we see them at the high point, and we see that they did make it. And they had the right ideas. So 16, in the end, wicked madness may approach the idea of utter insanity. It involves both the moral and mental elements that are indicative of the fool. And again, it's not just a mental element, although the fool may not be very articulate. He may be dumb at a certain level. He may not be well educated. That's not his problem. There are people who are not educated, but who are highly positive. And those people do just fine. And they don't require 150 IQ to do it. They may have a 95-point IQ, which is within the normal range. Maybe to the low end of normal, but it's still within the normal range, and they do just fine. And it doesn't require a lot of intelligence. Because all it requires is faith, of course, which can be indicative of little children. So 17, the Net Bible, the New English Translation, suggests the terms beginning and end form a merism, a figure of speech in which the two opposites are contrasted to indicate totality. For instance, in Psalm 139:8, that type of figure of speech is used to give you an idea. Two extremes to point out that it covers the whole. If I ascend to heaven, you are there. That's the extreme up, we might say, as far up as you can go. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. Behold, you are there. And that's as far down as you can go. So if God's as high up as you can get and he's as far down as you can get, would not be suggested that he is everywhere in between? That there isn't anywhere you can go to get away from God? And the fact is, there isn't. And these verses, for instance, this merism is used to teach the doctrine that God is everywhere, that you can't escape him. So God resides, of course, through the highest of heavens. God is present physically within the known universe and outside the known universe. We call that his transcendence, that he lives outside the realm of what we would call time and space. God is transcendent, but he is also immanent in that he is in every place. Now, we do not buy into pantheism. All things are God. This pulpit is not God. It's a pulpit, for goodness sake. But is God present in every point in space, in time? Yes, God is. And that does not change. So here, again, you see this figure of speech, this merism, and then in Ecclesiastes, 3:2-8, where Solomon provides these extremes. Well, these extremes are set up to suggest that there's a time for everything, and it's not just the extremes, there's a time for everything in between. That it covers the whole of life, we might say. And these opposites here in chapter 3, verses 2-8, are designed to talk about the whole of life and the seasons of life that occur within it. And this indicates, again, a totality. So, point 18, in reality, the words of a fool are madness from start to finish. They may start out just as stupid, but ultimately, if one evaluates them and takes the whole thing as a whole, you won't find it to be satisfying. You won't find it to be anything you would endorse. 19, it would seem that the first part of verse 14 forms a concluding condemnation of the fool and his speech, which is reflected in the New American Standard translation of the introductory wow as yet. In verse 14, yet the fool multiplies words. causest, in the Hippiel there, the Rabbah, to make great or many. They've translated it by the word multiply. Causes to be many. He continues to talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. And that's not any good, as we see, because his first speech at very best is stupid, and at the very end it's insane. So anybody listening to that is susceptible to falling for stupidity or insanity. Well, I don't tend to want to listen to these people talk very much. I pretty much have an idea of what positive volition is. And any believer can have a bad time. I mean, any believer can have a bad day, a bad week, a bad month. He could have a bad year. David had a really bad year after Operation Bathsheba. God nearly killed him. He was just short of dying, but he recovered. Why? Because David ultimately was positive in all of that. God was pounding on him all the time, and he knew what was going on. David wasn't stupid. See, David didn't rationalize it away. He knew God was killing him, and he knew why. He would not rebound. There was this one sin he didn't want to deal with, and that was the Bathsheba incident. Obviously, there was the related sin of killing Uriah, although David himself didn't kill anybody. He just, you know, signed the death warrant for him. Just as the Jews didn't kill Jesus. Right? Of course they did. Of course David did. Whether he pulled the trigger or not, he's just as guilty. He is, in fact, the most guilty because he's the one that articulated the idea in the first place. Nobody else thought of this but David. This came out of the evil and insanity in his own soul because he'd been caught. And you go back and you find, you know, if you really study the story, people focus on the shocking aspects of it. And yeah, it's shocking. Killing a guy and taking his wife, that's not cool. No, don't do that. Or kill some woman and take her husband. That's not cool either. Other way, you can have it both ways, I guess. But most women that have had a husband aren't going to do that. They may be smarter than men in that regard, and probably are, unfortunately. Well, the point is here, Solomon, this guy talks, it just goes on and on. And it never gets any better. And it just continues to deteriorate. 20 others suggest that the first part of this is not a conclusion as much as it is an introduction to what follows in the rest of the verse. I think it's a link to what follows in the rest of the verse, but I think it is a concluding thought of the end about his speech. Yet he multiplies words. In spite of the fact that his talking accomplishes nothing, and really less than nothing, because it's downright negative at that level in its effects, he continues to talk. 21, in either case, it is clear the fool does not have enough sense to keep his mouth shut as he pontificates on subjects that are beyond his ability and not within his understanding. I like hearing people talk about things I know they don't know anything about. I find it fun to listen to them sometimes. You know, I just sit there, oh, you stupid. That is just as stupid as anything I've ever heard. You have no clue. And they, you know, they pontificate there. And now given, you know, the nature of the BCS, they'll be pontificating all day today on who's going to win. Guess what? We won't know till the polls come out. But, you know, I can't make my $20 million a year here sitting on TV talking if I don't talk about this. And some of these people, no doubt, are fools. So he doesn't know enough. He pontificates on subjects that are beyond his ability. It's like watching a little child try to explain physics to you. You know he can't do it. You know he doesn't understand it. You know he doesn't grasp it. He doesn't see the many, many issues that he's completely oblivious to. But yet he continues to go on and on. 22, the first part of verse 14, which indicates that the fool multiplies words, should be understood to mean that the fool talks a lot. 23, the fool generates a lot of words to express himself. However, the problem is that he has nothing of any real consequence to assert. 24, one of the marks of the foolish and his words is the effusiveness of it all. Sometimes, many times, often, all the time, who knows? He may talk just for the sake of being heard. But he's assuming he is winning you over to his foolish viewpoint, his stupidity. And one has to recognize, and this is the nature of positive volition and humility, you have to recognize when you're being stupid and figure it out for what it is, admit it, deal with it, and move on. If you don't, you end up just yakking and yakking and yakking and da da da. You got nothing to say. 25, the fool is certain that he thinks, if he thinks it, it must be correct. Further, since he thinks it and now knows it to be correct, he must be articulated. Everything must be stated. No, everything must not be stated. Sometimes one is better off just to let things go. And there are things that, again, it doesn't do any good. There's a lie, it's an old song from the Guess Who. Talking won't do it and walking won't rush it along. You can't work some things out by talking them to death. Although you might want to try. You can't. Certain things can't be worked out just by yakking, 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 and yakking. Doesn't solve anything. 26, the fool is all too willing to shoot off his mouth about any subject. I like the fact that the fool doesn't really care what subject it is. He's going to talk about it. He knows something about it. He must know something about it. With minimal, zero encouragement, you don't have to encourage these people very often. They've got plenty to say. They can run their mouths, but guess what? The wise man comes up against them and can shut them down in a moment. Now, is it the will of God for the wise man to shut them down? Certain occasions, no. Certain, yes. Sometimes you just let the fool go his own stupid way. Hey, the bridge is out. I don't believe you. I'm doing it my way. Okay. Fool crashes into the bottom of the gully there, dead. Why? Because he wouldn't listen. He knew it all. He had it all figured out. He feels confident and fully qualified, despite his ignorance, to offer advice and predict the outcome of any future action. 27, he tends to talk about things of which he has no real knowledge. This is no more true than when the fool determines to explain the future to someone. Let me tell you how this is going to go, he says. Well, how's it going to go? He doesn't know. He doesn't know any more than I know. Anytime I hear anybody telling me, well, this is what's going to happen, I immediately take a step back mentally in my mind and say, wait a minute, you don't know that. You may say you know that, but you don't know that. And let's say for the moment that you're right. You still can't prove it because nobody really knows what the future holds. So we get up every day, of course, have to put the past behind us because all we have is today. And then we don't really have the future because nobody knows what the future holds. And why pontificate on it? Why worry about it? Wasn't this essentially what Jesus said? Don't worry about tomorrow. Today has enough trouble of its own. Because you can't really know what's coming tomorrow anyway. Let's assume tomorrow that the stock market goes to zero and all your investments are now worthless. Oh, it can't happen? I'll bet it can. I'm not saying it will. Let's say tomorrow, suddenly Americans get exuberant. Black Friday was great. Everybody shop till you drop. I didn't go out, thank you. I'll go out after Christmas when they're all done. Well, the point is, nobody knows what will happen. Maybe they get exuberant. Hey, Barack's taking office. Woo! And the market goes up 2,000 points. Who can predict it? Nobody can. That's the problem. Nobody really knows. And that's why, you know, the poor money managers, they have to try to tell people, okay, I know how to handle your money. What? How? You have to know the future to know that. Well, nobody knows the future. Everybody's got the same limitation right there. And that cuts off all human boasting, in my opinion, or should, especially if they're talking about the future. Why would you boast about the future? You have no idea what it holds. I look at these games, I mean, I want my team to win all the time. But like last week, I'm watching the Buccaneers, and I'm seeing, oh, here's the Lions. They're 0-10. Well, this will be an easy game. No. The Bucs never make nothing easy. Suddenly it's 17-0 Detroit, and I'm sitting there going, this wasn't what I had planned. But see, this is why you play football for 60 minutes, not 59 and a half. You know. The game comes out very different. It's a 60-minute game. How many games have you seen come down to the last 3, 2, 1, boom, there's a game. It's a 60-minute game, and you got to play for 60 minutes. So while I want my team to win, I never look at it and say, well, they're guaranteed to win. That's dumb. How would I know? I wouldn't. You don't. So again, he wants to predict the future. He tends to talk about things, point 27, of which he has no real knowledge, and this is no more true than when he determines to explain the future. 28, Solomon has already denied the fact that mankind has any real knowledge of what is coming in the future. Nevertheless, the fool not only thinks he knows what will happen, he will use as many words as possible to explain it to you. Ecclesiastes 3:22. Now, to me, that just smacks of fun. Listening to an idiot who doesn't know the future tell me for hours what the future is going to be. Why, that's just those minutes I'll never get back. I'm sitting here thinking, I wish I was dead. I don't want to listen to this. Please make it stop. My ears are bleeding. No, the fool's going to go on. Ecclesiastes 3:22. I have seen nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities. For that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? Implied answer, no one. No one will bring him to see. The only way you're going to see it is to live through it, and then it's too late. Then it becomes the past, right? Ecclesiastes 6:12. For who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime? During the few years of his transient life. I like transient here better because Solomon's talking about time rather than it's hevel. It's our word for futility or vanity. But I like when he's talking about time, I think the emphasis of the word is on its transience, on how quickly it goes by. That is quick. And again, as you get older, you become more in tune to this. Far more in tune than you were when you were 21. Because when you were younger, what were you always thinking? I don't know when it started. I want to be older. You don't think that anymore, do you? You don't think, okay, come on, pile those years on now. I want to be older. I want to be infirmed. I want to have difficulty walking. No. When you're 21, you don't think about that. But when you're 14, you're thinking, I can't wait till I'm 16 and get my license. Then I'll be free. Boy, weren't we stupid. All of us. I can't wait till I'm 18. Then I can vote. Whoop-de-doo. The illusion of choice. I can't wait till I'm 21. Then I can drink. And then you spend the night puking in the gutter. Wow, that was fun. Can't wait till I get older. And then I can get married. Then once I'm married, I'll be happy. Oh, well, that didn't work out. How'd that work out for you? A marriage doesn't guarantee happiness. Nothing guarantees happiness. I'm not saying marriage can't be happy and blessed. It can be. It should be. But there's no guarantees. And when you're young, you're always thinking about the future and how you're going to... When you're old, you're busy looking back at the past. There was that one time there where you were 41 and a half. There was that one ideal day. But you just didn't know it. Now, 41 and a half, you had one day where it was just everything was right. And you weren't busy doing either. Well, here also 7:14, next one. In the day of prosperity, be happy, but in the day of adversity, consider God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not discover anything that will be after him. And 8:7. Because no one knows what will happen, who can tell him how it will happen? So if you don't know what's going to happen, how are you going to tell me how it's going to unfold? Well, I predict such and such team's going to win. Fine, tell me how they're going to do it. Are they going to win by running the ball successfully or passing better? Which one's it going to be? Oh, are they going to mix it up perfectly? 50 runs, 50 passes. There you go. Are they going to win it with defense? Are they going to win it with offense? Tell me how they're going to win if you're so certain. Fact is, you don't know. And this goes on all the time in life, so much so that people don't even think about it. Now, I think the weatherman got it right. They predicted windy today. Okay, let's hear it for the weatherman. He got it right. But if you can also study certain pressure gradients, you could figure this out by yourself. You didn't need the weatherman to tell you. Well, we've got high pressure over here and low here, and the temperature gradient changes and all that. And the pressure gradient changes, winds increase. Well, that's just simple elementary worldly knowledge. You can figure that out. But you have to have, obviously, a barometer to measure the pressure, so you would know. Well, 29, nowhere is this more evident than within the media. We have fools that predict weather, sporting events, elections, economic developments, and every sort of event that has not occurred as yet. That's why we need the chairman of the Fed. We have to have him because, see, he's got this weird power. He can stand there and he looks out into the future like this. And he sees what's coming. And he says, that evil dog inflation, I see it. It's coming over the edge of the horizon. And so we got to change the interest rates because I can see the future. Wrong. Or now it's completely backwards. Now the Fed's just reacting to everything that happens, and now they're just changing interest rates in reaction rather than in anticipation. Neither one's very good, but the fact is they pontificate on everything. 30, this is not to say. On the other hand, now let me qualify this for you. This is not to say that there are not useful sources of information and legitimate research. Now, how do you know, given the nature of the media today, given the nature of the world, how do you know what research is even legitimate sometimes? People have a great ability to present facts and statistics in such a way as to prove a particular point of view while actually skewering the facts. But you present them in a certain way, and so it becomes what you want it to be. And then you got these internet sites that are constantly making these outlandish assertions. And one of the big ones, and whether it's true or not, I don't know, maybe we'll never find out whether or not Obama's really a legitimate U.S. citizen. And if he's not, he can't be president unless they're going to just totally take the Constitution and trash it. Well, what are they afraid of, right? Oh, has that been going on? Yeah, undermine it. Guess what? We may never know. Well, I hold dual citizenship in 14 countries. Okay. Dual citizenship just implies two, but that's all right. Don't let that bother you. Well, the fact is, there are many things that go fly around out here. You got certain websites that are devoted to UFOs, and they've done their research, and, well, who believes them? I don't. You know? And you got people obviously presenting things in the mainstream media skewed along the lines of the predetermined outcome. And we don't know. So when you get information, number one, you got to be careful about it. Some people hear one thing and they go off half-cocked. And that was a bad thing, going off half-cocked. But people hear something, they react to it, they jump with it. This must be true. Is it verifiable? If it's true, it's verifiable. But is it verifiable? And I recognize that there are some things that are true that you're not probably going to be able to verify. For instance, we talk about the super elite rich of the last days manipulating human history and withholding the pay of the laborers who mowed their fields and who manipulate world economies and all of that. But where are these men? Do you know any of them? I don't know any of them. I believe they exist, but I believe they operate best under the cloak of secrecy. I think it serves their purposes. So again, it's not to say that there aren't some legitimate sources of research and information. However, seeking to anticipate future trends and developments is far different than dogmatically asserting that one possesses absolute knowledge about the future. You do see the difference, I hope, that we're not against legitimate research. And all of that, we know that certain scientific research has yielded great breakthroughs. We don't have polio anymore. That's good. We harness technology in order to take images of the human body with an X-ray. Well, that's good. That's helpful. It's also dangerous to the body, but it is helpful for diagnosticians. So we have some things that are legitimate information, legitimate research that's valuable. So we don't want to, on the one hand now, we recognize that fools can really make you want to throw up your hands and just quit. But we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Well, 31, even today, with the masses of research data readily available, attempting to forecast the future is a notoriously unreliable practice. And we can pick any area again. What do you think will happen tomorrow, next week, next month, next year? No one knows. It does seem that the consensus of wisdom out there is that this economic situation is not going to change for a year or more. Who knows? Something could happen. It could change in 6 months. If the rapture happened, the economic developments in the United States are going to change dramatically. And probably all over the world. Think about it. Unemployment will suddenly be reduced to zero if a person wants to work. They may force people to work that don't even want to. We've got to fill this position. The economic fortunes of this country can turn around in a second, in a heartbeat. Even Creed even acknowledges that in one of their songs. There was a line, "Isn't it funny how life can change in an instant?" An instant can change everything. And we don't know. And our knowledge, and this is what Solomon does. He takes his younger audience and he takes them through and points out to them, you really don't know anything, do you? He does it in a nice way. He doesn't come up and say, stupid. But he does it in a nice way and he points out that no one really knows. And since no one knows, why would anyone attempt to say that they do? That tells you right off the bat, you're probably dealing with a fool. Well, 32, once again, Solomon states with certainty that no one from among mankind has any knowledge of the future. 33, he is not denying divine revelation as a means of knowing what will happen. He is talking strictly about human abilities and the lack of human knowledge about the future that exists under the sun. And he says, nobody can tell him. This is what we see out here in the world, though. People attempting to say they know the future. No one knows the future. Sure, can you use data and research and all to predict? Yeah, you can. You can predict, but just recognize that that's all it is. It's just a prediction. It's not really a fact. And if you turn out to be right, guess what? You may be right today and wrong tomorrow. There's no guarantee you're going to be right all the time. So 34, the fact is, we do know that something is coming in the future. However, we should be very cautious about those that claim to have some esoteric knowledge that we do not have. Some hidden knowledge. I know the date of the rapture. Uh-oh. Sign of the cross. Run the other way. This person doesn't know. And yet they may claim to. How many date setters have we seen come and go in history? And really, if you go back and research it, there have been probably millions of them, thousands at least, of people setting dates, had the plan of God all figured out. They've got, you know, a date, you know, a particular day. They've pontificated a day of creation. Which day was creation on? Well, it was Kislev 17 or whatever. Well, they don't know. They can't even fully tell us about the past. They can't harmonize the Bible and the Egyptian chronology and the Assyrian chronology, which tells me there's some pretty big problems. If you can't harmonize known facts, then you got a problem. And that's just with dealing with the past. Okay, time's up. We'll stop there. Let's take our normal 20-minute break.